Greetings, friends. Welcome back to Critically Acclaimed, the film review podcast slogan. My name is Whitney Seibold. I am a film critic of absolutely no renown. And with me, as always, is my far more talented, charming, and better articulated co-host. William, why don't you introduce yourself?
Because I'm waiting for you to give yourself your proper due. Humility is a little overrated, I feel, but...
I can give myself a Mountain Dew, anyway.
Well, that would be delicious for you.
No, actually, it wouldn't. No, I hate Mountain Dew.
I regret saying
Mountain
that immediately.
Nasty.
Wait, we have commercials now. Just wait. We were just brought to you by Mountain Dew or something.
Oh, there we go. Brought to you, no doubt. Brought to you by Surge.
Oh, God.
Remember Surge and Fruitopia?
Brought to you by Orbitz. My name is William Bibbiani. I am a critic. Everybody calls me Bibbs. I am honored to be here, as always, with one of my favorite film critics in the world, Whitney Seibold.
Oh, pshaw.
This is Critically Acclaimed, and we are reviewing some new releases this week. And those new releases are Marvel's Eternals, Bob Lorraine's Spencer, the new Netflix Western, The Harder They Fall, the post-apocalyptic robot movie Finch, and the turn-of-the-century biopic, The Electrical Life of Louis Wayne.
Okay.
If you would like to see The Electrical Life of Louis Wayne, press 1.
What would you like to talk about first, William?
Well, let's talk about the big one, I guess. We usually go in, like...
Highest-profile release,
yeah,
most advertised, highest earner, whatever you want to say.
There's a decent chance the majority of our listeners want to hear about it, because majority of listeners would have seen it. And let's talk about Marvel's Eternals. This is the fifth film in the Marvel cycle.
It's the 26th film in the Marvel cycle. This is Avengers Part 26. Surpassed James Bond at this point.
Good for them. Yeah. Is that only the Eon Productions, though? I think if you include, like, Never Say Never Again in the 1960s Casino Royale.
I think No Time to Die was the 25th Eon production of the James Bond
series. By mid-next year, Marvel will surpass James Bond.
More or less. I actually don't know what the next one is, and I don't really care.
Someone asked me online what my favorite James Bond movies were, and I included some of the non-Eon films, like Never Say Never Again and
sure,
the 1960s Casino
Royale. A lot of the sticklers said, hey, wait a minute.
Well, someone pointed out that, like, the OCD part of me just isn't comfortable seeing those, and I'm like, the OCD part of me isn't comfortable not including them. I want to include every single James Bond
as complete as possible.
Just because Eon didn't make it doesn't mean it's not real, But Marvel Cinematic Universe has been going strong right from the beginning. Started big, only got bigger, and now it's getting a little bit weirder.
And is still big. They're reaching into a corner of the Marvel Universe that was typically referred to as the cosmic part of the universe.
Mm-hmm.
Not just took place in space, but dealt with a pantheon of gods.
Yeah.
There is a pantheon of gods in the Marvel Universe.
Quite a few, actually. Mm-hmm. Many of them competing.
And I'm not just talking about Thor. Thor's just some dude. I'm talking about these gigantic, massive, usually depicted as like 200-foot-tall deities that control and make up the very warp and weft and fabric of the universe.
Many of whom are like sort of responsible for different parts of the universe. Mm. There's the Living Tribunal, which is responsible for keeping things balanced in the universe. Mm. There's Eternity, the being in which all the universe lives within. Mm. We're just a tiny infinitesimal part of one guy.
Yeah.
That's the Marvel Universe. It's a weird
eternity.
Place.
And they kind of hinted at a lot of this stuff before in Guardians of the Galaxy, Eternity was name-checked.
There's a sequence that takes place inside the head of a Celestial.
And a Celestial is a robot-looking being, cosmic being, a deity of some kind, that creates planets.
Yeah, well, it kind of creates life in the universe, as we find here.
And there are many of them, and there is a Celestial called, is it Asherem?
Arishem.
Arishem. And Arishem has communication with this race of immortal beings called Eternals. They are sent to Earth at the beginning of this movie in ancient times, ancient Earth. They land on Earth 7,000 years ago.
Right, pretty much at the start of intelligent life.
At the start of civilization.
And
they're there to fight these gangly monsters called deviants.
Mm-hmm.
And protect human beings from these deviants,
which are basically the predator that hunts intelligent life.
Yeah. And not only they're not only there to hunt these deviants, but they're also there to essentially aid humanity in evolution and make sure civilization thrives. So one of them is an inventor, and there's a sequence where one of the Eternals says, I've invented a steam engine. And they say, you're a couple thousand years too early for that. He says, okay, well, I'll help them invent a plow. Hmm. The Eternals are, they're dressed like superheroes. The Trekkie part of my brain wishes they had looked a little bit more like aliens, like a space alien of some kind. They don't look like space aliens. They look like regular human beings. They're played by actors like Gemma Chan. She plays a character named Cersei. Mm-hmm. And
Richard Madden plays a heroic type named Icarus.
Icarus.
Angelina Jolie plays a warrior named Athena. It kind of goes on like that.
The idea is that they have names like beings from ancient mythology because we as humans received the names from these space aliens and incorporated them into our mythology.
Yeah.
I like that.
That's fine.
I like this sort of alternate view of human history as aided by space aliens. There's something very Star Trek about it.
Well, I mean, but it's been here since pretty much the beginning. Yeah. Thor already articulated that Asgardians are just a race of godlike, very long-living aliens, and they visited Earth a few times and kind of got welded into our history because they really liked Norway for some reason.
They were a little too... Thor is a little too concerned with what's going on in like his home dimension of wacky frost giants and swinging hammers and stuff.
Right.
And then he starts tooling around with like Captain America. It's like,
he's not in charge of the grand
sort of growth of humanity as a species. So we get to see throughout a long series of flashbacks where these Eternals were throughout the course of human history until we finally skirt our way up to the present. Where we've sort of been given all of this backstory. This is a film directed by Chloe Zhao, who just won an Academy Award for Nomadland, which also won the Academy Award for Best Picture. And Chloe Zhao is known for downbeat indie dramas that deal with a lot of sort of natural light and the natural world. Nomadland is very much about the unseen parts of America and what that looks like. She's a very odd choice to make a superhero drama, but I think she does a really good job of that sort of Arthur C. Clarke notion of incorporating these superhero characters into the broader scope of human history. And there are a lot of really wonderful, very beautiful shots, very naturally lit actual location shots, which is very refreshing, of the Eternals sort of having conversations about aiding humanity and how they feel about that. I like all of that stuff. All of the superhero stuff is bad.
All the superhero stuff is just kind of generic. I mean, it looks fine. I mean, there's some neat stuff here and there. But like,
they have pretty typical superhero powers. Yeah. One of them can create illusions in the air. One of them can fire little blasts out of his hands. One can fire little blasts out of his eyes.
One of them is very fast. Mm. One of them can heal things, etc. And there's nothing wrong with these things. But there's also, because these are godlike beings who have been around for many thousands of years, there's no sense of wonder to these things. They're just things they do. Mm. And there's something kind of interesting about just people who've been around for so long that the wondrous is humdrum. Mm. But it's also not necessarily the most exciting thing to watch is to see them cut loose on stuff that to them is old hat.
Yeah.
So the
action and the fight scenes are like the least engaging parts of
this. No, they're the parts I remember the absolute least.
There's a kind of a fun one in, like, a forest thicket. And by the time we get to the present day, the Eternals have essentially split up. Some of them had relationships. In fact, Icarus and Cersei were married at one point. I don't think they ever really divorced. They just sort of drifted apart.
Well, I mean, it's...
There's a character named Kingo, played by Kumail Nanjiani, who broke off and became multiple generations of Bollywood stars.
Yeah, so it's like...
Because he's eternal. He's been posing as, like, multiple generations.
So he's been, like, making movies, like, since the silent era, and whenever it feels like he should be getting older, he's just replaced by, oh, it's his son! His son is taking over the family acting dynasty, and he's been doing this for a while. Kumail Nanjiani is funny because he's Kumail Nanjiani, and he brings a lot of levity into this sometimes kind of dour proceeding, and it's oftentimes that sort of Marvel quippiness is so it's so dense. There's so much of it that it no longer feels special. Here, we needed a little bit. Well, we needed a little bit of humor here, a little bit of levity.
Ponderousness that's leavened by humor. Yeah. And I appreciate, actually, the Chloe Zhao's balance between those things.
Yeah.
There's a character named Sprite, played by Leah McHugh, and she's a sort of an androgynous figure, and she is also
very young.
In the body of a 12-year-old. She's just as old as all the other people, right. But the way that... she's always been 12, just to the way she's been.
And when you're trying to live amongst the humans, that's incredibly limiting. However, it should be noted that her power is to present illusions. Mm. And when we first meet them in the movie, in the present day, they are using their illusions to look like an adult. And one can't help but wonder, why don't you just do that? Mm. Doesn't that kind of solve your problem for the most part? I mean, there's still some limitations to it, but... a lot of the things you complain about, you could just wave away with a flick of your hand. Mm. So, minor inconsistency there.
No.
Minor character inconsistency.
There's a character named Makari, played by Lauren Ridloff. She's the fast runner. Mm. She's also deaf and communicates through sign. It's presented completely incidentally. I
appreciate
that.
I saw some people complaining online. This is the stupidest thing.
Some people complaining online is not a conversation we should ever have.
I just want to make one complaint. If you found this distracting, I just want to make this point. Some people were like, hey... like, American Sign Language hadn't been invented yet, 8,000 years ago.
It's a 20th century invention.
And I'm like, they're also all speaking English. Just go with it.
And that's something I wish they had addressed a little bit. Like, get into, the techniques. Like, here's the translator, or we're speaking Eternals language now. They're all just using their own voices.
We just accept it.
We just accept that.
No, we don't care. We don't even need to even go through that motion, I think.
Yeah, there's a character named Gilgamesh. I guess we named Gilgamesh after him.
The ancient
Sumerians named Gilgamesh after him. It's played by an actor named Don Lee. He has super-powered boxing gloves, essentially. Yeah. Just slam his fists into stuff.
Yeah, he's great. I love that actor. Athena was, of course, played by Angelina Jolie, and she was, of course, the basis for Athena. Hmm. None too subtle.
Although she even corrects somebody in dialogue. Oh, your name is Athena? No, it's just Athena. No, A. And the leader of the group is Ajax. I'm guessing we named Ajax after Ajax, played by Salma Hayek.
Mm-hmm.
And she is the one who can communicate with the celestial being about their multiple millennia mission on Earth. And partway through the movie, we do get this huge exposition dump as to the nature of their mission.
Like, why? It's cool that the celestial sent these Eternals to Earth to protect humanity from these monsters, but one has to wonder what's in it for the celestial, and when we find out what's in it for the celestial, there's this sort of just like, oh shit, that's not entirely good. But, and I do appreciate this, and I think this is one of the more interesting things about it, also not entirely bad.
Not entirely bad. There's a grand bit of ambiguity to there.
Yeah, there's basically life and death and the destruction of planets and the saving of planets and the human existence and all alien life that we've been introduced to in the universe. The comings and goings of that, the life and death of that, serves a function in the universe. Mm-hmm. And to protect, say, a species from being destroyed does have a ripple effect and can actually have problems, which is when, you know, species before humanity came around, species did go extinct once in a while.
Yeah.
It happened with less frequency and less, accelerating it. And that's a problem because we're fucking up this natural order. But there's also something to be said for, you know, like, oh, well, should we cure death? Isn't death part of it? Isn't death part of the natural life process? Should this endangered species be protected? Are they an important part of the ecosystem? The movie touches upon these things, and I really, really appreciate that. I like that these are characters who are basically gods, and Chloe Zhao treats them as gods. They might not be the gods that we know, but they affect the gods that we know. They represent the gods that we know throughout a variety of different religions. They even make a point, like, various characters in the movie equate them to DC Comics superheroes, which is weird.
It's weird, but it's apt.
Very apt.
And this is a conversation we had in high school a lot, that Marvel characters take place in the real world. They live in New York City, and they tend to be very grounded. They deal with real-world problems. They are super-powered beings, but they still have to, you know, get a paycheck.
Yeah.
Whereas the DC Comics characters tend to be more godlike figures. You have Wonder Woman, who is a god.
More elevated.
Yeah, we have Superman, who's this, like, immortal, essentially an indestructible alien.
Yeah, he has a job, but he doesn't need a job. Yeah. And that's kind of important.
Like, he's trying to assimilate, and you have your space cops like the Green Lantern.
So this is Marvel kind of acknowledging that basically these modern deities that we have in our fiction are also probably directly or indirectly influenced by these Eternals as well. So basically Marvel is saying, hey, you like Superman? You're welcome.
Yeah, here's Superman.
Which is like, Superman didn't come first, Marvel. It's a brassy move. I'm going to say that right now. But my point is this. These are gods, and we are experiencing the world through their godlike eyes, through their godlike experiences.
And looking at ourselves through
And looking
eyes,
at ourselves through that experience. But also, as the movie reveals more and more about why they are here, we are realizing that the Eternals and the gods that they believed in were not to be trusted. That actually a undying, unquestioning devotion to a higher power or
a grander cause,
perhaps, or even just some sort of nebulous entity that seeks ultimately only to self-perpetuate itself. And even if it does some good, it is ultimately exploiting those underneath them. That's a bold thing to put in a blockbuster, especially one coming from Disney. Because it ends up getting feeling a little subversive coming from Disney. Or coming from someone making it under Disney's banner, rather. Yeah. Reminded a bit of the Tim Burton Dumbo, which argued that the very worst thing anyone could ever do was sell their creation to Disney.
Weaponizing the imagination, the use of the word dream in that Dumbo movie is pretty sinister.
Yeah, it's an underrated film, I feel.
There's a lot of really interesting ideas and themes at play in Eternals. This idea of faith and fanaticism is a big part of it. The idea of the grand place of humanity and superheroes' place in it. Mm-hmm. Or I don't want to even say superheroes. Immortals and deities within, like, with practical ground level interaction with humanity.
Or one could even argue that that relates to humanity's itself, our ability to dramatically affect our surroundings, our ability to change the climate, our ability to change the geography of the planet, our ability to blow things up. Are these not godlike things?
There's also this the idea of, you know, if there are gods among us, why are there bad things still happening? And the argument of the movie is, we do that shit. We're responsible for it. But we're making our own decisions.
It also argues that gods, and this is something I like because it's a little cynical, gods don't care about that shit.
Yeah,
gods
yeah.
care about their own shit. They have their own things that they care about, and all the things that we care about, they don't really care.
They care about, because these are Eternals, they're thinking of things in terms of millennia. They don't care about, you know, this one war that's only going to last a mere century. That'll be over soon enough. Things will pick back up again.
Yeah.
It's like, well, what about the century of atrocities? It'll end eventually for us, and we'll just keep on living.
Yeah.
For us, we'll still be alive, even though, you know, millions of people are dying.
It's like, for them, it's like losing. Some of them are very empathetic towards humans, and they really, really care. Others are basically just like, yeah, are you really going to lose sleep because an ant colony outside your door lost a war with the crickets? Yeah. Like, no.
the termites killed all the ants. So,
Yeah, like, bummer for the ants, but I'm not going to lose any sleep.
I still have to go to work. Yeah. It's,
I got my own shit.
So, and what I appreciate about the Eternals as well is, even though they've been expressly directed by their god boss not to interfere with human history or anything that has nothing to do with deviants. So that explains why they weren't around in previous Marvel films.
Yeah, there were no deviants, so it's not their business. Yeah, they have one job.
It's like, well, what about that Ultron thing? Well, Ultron's your own business. You made that. Take care of it.
Knock yourself out.
We're not coming in here to save you. We're thinking in terms of millennia. All of that is really, really fascinating. I love that it's all being brought up. And these characters, even though they're letting sort of humanity sort of hurt themselves from time to time, they're full of love. And that's not something you get from a lot of these other superhero characters. They're usually motivated by determination or justice or some sort of self-interest. They're not really motivated by deep compassion, and I think that's the greatest strength of Eternals, is it is a deeply compassionate film that loves the characters, and the characters love each other. And when
and many of them love humanity, and when they have a connection.
When they have a falling out, it actually has a profound effect on their relationships and the way they operate. It feels a lot more honest this time around. It's really unfortunate that this has to be a superhero film, because the action is really kind of murky and uninteresting.
Yeah.
And seeing them walk around in the superhero costumes and talking about, like, Tony Stark and Captain America. However grand the machinations of sort of the Avengers plots have been, you know, we're building up to this gigantic fight where there's just going to be 1,000 people together fighting an army of evil aliens.
Yeah.
It's actually all pretty simple.
Yeah.
It might be a lot of it, but it's a really simple story, and now we're dealing with sort of these bigger ideas about sort of the vast scope of human history and the motivations of gods living among us, and it makes the Marvel Universe seem kind of piddling in comparison. Well,
yeah, because it is, in comparison to, like, the vast history of the universe, the Marvel... I mean, it's an interesting anecdote in the history of the universe, but is it really the biggest deal? No. The one time it almost was a big deal, we reversed it in 5 years.
Which is nothing to an Eternal.
Whatsoever to an Eternal, so who cares?
We were delayed, like, 5 years. So what? Five years. I've been alive for 7,000 years.
I'm with you on this, and I think it's really nice to see a superhero movie of any kind, from any particular franchise, doesn't really matter, that has some really big things on its mind, that really wants to use the idea of larger-than-life beings to explore issues that are beyond the scope of a typical film. Many Marvel movies, and I think even DC movies, are interested in very typical things. Human foible, human frailty, ego, fanaticism or whatever. Like, I guess this deals with fanaticism too, but, like, you know, there's a certain formula to it. This breaks that formula, and I appreciate that. So every single time it reverts to that formula, even momentarily, it feels tacked on. The things, I don't mind the costumes. I don't mind the costumes. They're aliens. They had to get clothes from somewhere. I don't mind that they didn't invent khakis. Like if they want to have weird alien costumes and a spaceship that feels like it came straight out of David Lynch's Dune, I'm fine with all of that. That's fine. I actually like that we're seeing some of the weirder Jack Kirby designs being brought to life. Arishem looks cool. Like, this giant...
It actually has, like, it is enormous.
Yeah, you get a real good sense of scale, which I really appreciate. That's all that shit's cool. I like all of that. I like that stuff. But there's a scene in the movie, and it's kind of played off as a joke, and it feels like it's only there for the trailer. Most of the Eternals have gotten back together. There's, like, a couple we haven't found yet, but they're on it's like the Muppets. We're trying to get the gang back together.
Yeah.
We found most of them, and we're all having dinner. And it's nice to see these people just communicate. You've got a wonderful ensemble cast. Let them talk. They have so much history together. And then Sprite says, so who do you think is going to lead the Avengers now that Captain America and Iron Man are gone? And I'm like, why do you give a shit? Like, I'm watching this. I'm like, I don't understand why you care.
Why these people would be interested
because,
at all.
Because, A, you're Eternals. These people are blibs. And B, given everything going on, and I don't want to go into too much detail about the big revelations about the universe, etc., but given everything going on right now, there's a ticking clock and the whole world's going to collapse in on itself, this is what you're going to talk about? Because if we don't resolve the actual conversation we're having at the dinner table, no one is going to take over the Avengers because the world's going to be over within a week. So this feels really... Just, it's not even tacked on. It's like a little post-it.
You know what
just
it feels?
Just been thrown onto the script.
That scene brought to mind another superhero film that came out earlier this year called Flora and Ulysses.
Wow.
About a superpowered squirrel.
Oh, another Disney film.
Very much a Disney film, because there seemed to be added scenes in that film where they made reference to, like, newly acquired IP. So there's, like, a Star Wars scene, and they dubbed in
Wolverine
lines.
Shows up in that as a comic book, but still, this is like the first movie where Marvel acknowledged that they own Wolverine and can do whatever they want with him now.
Yeah, so they put him in, yeah. in this squirrel movie.
Yeah.
They dubbed in the line, I love you 3000, which is from one of the Avengers movies.
Yeah, they fucking did.
Like,
yeah.
That was ADR. There's, so
the child installs into the house's doorbell the Imperial March from Star Wars, and I'm like, do you hate your family? Are you saying they're like the Empire? Is that because that's not what's in the movie. The movie suggests you quite like your family. That's really weird. None of it makes any sense. None of it feels tangible. None of it feels like there's a really good reason to put this in there. It's organic and it makes sense. It feels
like a commercial exercise.
Yeah. There's one little bit at the beginning where I was like, "That I'm fine with this because this is actually a casual conversation that would come up.
Yeah.
Cersei is dating a human played by Kit Harington from Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
And she's very secretive. And he makes a joke. It's like, I know why you're very secretive and won't let me come over to your apartment. You're a wizard, aren't you? Because that's a thing now.
Yeah, there are like, wizards.
So you're secretive because there's all this magical shit and you're one of them, right?
And she does have magical powers. Her power is she can transform inanimate objects into other inanimate objects.
Yeah, she can turn water into rock and vice versa.
There's a scene where a bus is about to hit somebody and she turns it into flower petals. That's very nice.
It's a neat image, actually.
All of the interaction between the characters and the characters themselves are really great.
Yeah.
It's when it has to reach into the Marvel bag that it feels like it's stretching into territory it doesn't want to be in.
Yeah.
And it does, of course, have to end in a big fight. I appreciate that the fight is between, without giving too much away, the fight is between the Eternals.
Yeah, it's a difference of opinion.
There's deviants out there, and the deviants do come into play, but the real climax is who's going to win this physical fight, which represents their opposite points of view. And I find that way more interesting than good guys fighting bad guys.
Without revealing too much, I like that before that big climax, they're all deciding what everyone's values are, and there's one person who says, I see both sides of this argument. I actually agree with this side more, but not enough to fight over it, so I'm leaving.
Yeah. Because
I'm just a conscientious objector here, where I may mostly agree with one side, but I don't believe in the fight, so I'm just going to go because I see a point either way. I thought that was very refreshing. Mm-hmm. It seems a little anticlimactic, but it's actually very well thought out.
Yeah.
And it works, and I really liked it.
Because the nature of this genre, they tend to be action pictures and thrillers, and we want to thrill when somebody comes to sort of a big physical triumph where they beat up a bad guy and they best the bad guy and save the day. The Eternals save the day. It's a superhero movie,
right?
But it doesn't. It's not about overcoming evil. It's not about good guys versus bad guys. Well, it is this sort of conflict of ideas, and the effect of which affects sort of the very fabric of the universe. And I appreciate that it is about those ideas, but at the same time, it's really hard to get behind some of the clunkier, more traditional aspects of the superhero genre.
Agreed. And because I feel like what Chloe Zhao is using here to great effect is, again, a lot of our ideas of what a superhero story can be. Just the name superhero. It's kind of arbitrary, actually. What these are larger-than-life beings with powers greater than a normal person. Mm-hmm. Even if they are human, maybe their skill set is so dramatically beyond ours that they're functionally superheroic. Or functionally superhuman. Mm-hmm. We're used to seeing that in a punch-em-up. Mm-hmm. But if you look at the grand history of storytelling tradition, yeah, there's some of that. Hercules and Gilgamesh and the like.
Gilgamesh.
Poor choice. Hercules is a good example.
Yes.
But a lot of the stories of larger-than-life beings throughout human history are melancholic.
They're not spiritual. They're not all about war, which is what superhero stories tend to be about.
If you look at the various mythologies, Greek or Norse, Norse is a bit more war-centric in its plotting, but there's still other stories in it. You look at Christianity. Mm. You look at there's a wide variety throughout the history of the world of stories of people with great powers who are
doing gentle things,
or doing thoughtful things, or questioning themselves, or being deeply flawed. And not actually doing heroic things at all. Sometimes doing shitty things, selfish things, sexy things. Mm. there's a lot of that. And I feel like Chloe Zhao was trying to get to that. So every time it just falls back on a Marvel thing, it feels like a little counterproductive. But I will say this. At the end of the day, it's an odd film in some respects. It's an odd mixture of Chloe Zhao's approach to this and the Marvel cinematic sort of blender in which it has to get thrown into. But I think the good outweighs the bad. I think it's a really, really strong cast. I think it has a lot of interesting ideas, more than pretty much any other Marvel movie, which is, even the good ones tend to be a little straightforward. And I ultimately like it, and I appreciate that they took a big swing. I appreciate that it's kind of weird. And, you know, I dig this one. It's a bit... I think when all is said and done, when we look back at this one, we'll appreciate how different it was.
Yeah, well, it's I appreciate now how different it is. I actually do like this film. It reminded me a lot less of Marvel Comics and more of like Arthur C. Clarke and science fiction novels that tried to deal with these big ideas. Have you read Childhood's End?
I haven't read that one.
No. Okay, yeah, that's about how it's actually very much like Eternals. Humanity is contacted by space aliens. They said,
like
we're going to give you technology, but we're not going to show you what we look like. We're going to stay on our ships. You're not ready to look at us. And we think, oh, what kind of weird Lovecraftian horrors exist? And after a good span of time, a long time has passed, they say, okay, now we've advanced enough. We're going to present ourselves to you now. And they step out and they essentially look like the devil. Like they
literally
like bat wings and horns and like red skin and tails.
We're too given to superstition to have.
Yeah, it's like, so we look, this is how we look. And by the time they land, it's like, okay. And when they start, sort of mucking around in person, we realize that they're sort of taking some humans aside and saying, you know, let's do something to your brain because you're evolving and we're here to help you evolve.
Yeah, so they are benevolent. They just look weird.
They look like demons. Satanic, and eventually we do learn that they answer to a higher power and it's their job to help species evolve. This is what the Eternals is about as well.
I actually was a really big fan of, I didn't read all of it, so I can't, maybe it stopped being good, but I was a really big fan of the Ultimate Fantastic Four comics. I actually think it was this rebooted thing, and the Fantastic Four were all teenagers. It was the Josh Trank movie was a little bit beholden to it, but it didn't do it nearly a good job. But there was this one bit where they go to a place called the Negative Zone.
Okay.
Which is this fantastical dimension, and the Fantastic Four had been there multiple times. And it's led, in the original comics, by this horrifying demon robot-y kind of thing called Annihilus.
Oh, I know Annihilus.
He's giant and green, has big wings, and he's going to kill us all.
It looks like a big robot bug.
And there's a bit in this Ultimate Universe where they meet Annihilus for the first time, and they're like, uh-oh. And he's like, nah, it's a different language. It doesn't mean in my language what it means in your language. I realize how bad that sounds. That's not.
I would explain a character like Sinestro.
Yeah, like, in my universe, that's like Mike. Like, it doesn't mean, I don't have this, like, Latin root for you to, like, get. Also, what would that mean? Left-handed? Like, I'm really left-handed? What the hell? Of course, Annihilus ends up actually being a bad guy instead of Sinestro, but that's considered more ironic than anything else.
There's an episode of Star Trek Lower Decks where this robot that has recently developed like consciousness.
Yeah.
It's like, well, I speak robot language, so I decided I got to choose my own name that I get to communicate to you corporeal beings. What's your name? My name is Peanut Hamper. Like, what? Okay, Ensign Peanut Hamper, welcome aboard.
Yeah.
Like fun words to the
thank you for bringing this back around to Star Trek. We should move on.
I got to bring it around to Star Trek.
We should move on. Where do you want to go next?
Let's talk about Spencer.
Let's do it. So this is the latest film from Pablo Larraine. Pablo Larraine has been making movies for quite a while, but most people know him from his more recent biopic of Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis, called Jackie.
Yeah.
It stars Natalie Portman as the former First Lady of the United States over a period of time when she was dealing with the crisis of her husband being assassinated, her being basically shoved aside so that a new administration can take over, even though she's still kind of a figurehead for the country, while she's also trying to plan the funeral of one of the most beloved politicians in history.
And dealing with all of, you know, the personal mourning and grieving that she has to go through, having witnessed her husband murdered in front of her.
And that movie is great. That's a really good film.
It's quite good. Pablo Larraine is a very downbeat, kind of dour filmmaker. And So the biographies he chooses to tell tend to focus on sort of the downbeat elements of his subjects' lives.
It's easy to draw a big parallel between Jackie and Spencer because they're both stories of women who married into these like long dynasties of powerful men or powerful families anyway, and focuses on them in a time of crisis. In the case of Spencer, we're dealing with Princess Diana, who I realize probably died before a lot of the people who are listening to this podcast were born.
She died in 1997, and she was not just the Princess of Wales, part of the royal family, but she was one of the biggest figures you'd see in a tabloid.
Beyond that, she was just one of the most popular human beings in the world. She was
her wedding to Charles was one of the like highest rated events in TV history. I think might still be one of the highest rated events.
It was considered. My mother was very, very interested in the royal family, and she would constantly read like British magazines imported to our local newsstand, and she would just follow all of this. And initially, a lot of the sort of star-studded appeal of Princess Diana was that she came from outside of that world. She was not royalty who just married another royal and that was that. She was a person who then married royalty. Holy shit, this is something out of a Disney movie. Oh my God. Everything's incredible. The fashions are incredible. Everything seems really, really wonderful. And then you found out what she was actually going through, and it turns out it was hell.
Yeah.
It was absolutely hell. It was an emotionally unavailable family. No sooner than were they married than, in fact, I think even before, than her husband was already sleeping with his old lover. Not even hiding it after a while.
And this was sort of like an expected thing that she was meant to tolerate.
The royal family was basically just like, yeah, it's the same shit as always. But someone from outside of it, no, this is not a healthy environment. This is not something that is to be accepted. And when we meet her in Pablo Larraín's Spencer, as played by Kristen Stewart, it takes place over the Christmas holiday. Basically, while she is at the point of deciding what she is going to do. Is she going to just play her role and be part of this charade and be miserable for the rest of her life? Is she going to perhaps stand up for herself and assert her individuality, which of course she ended up actually doing. And this is something the movie actually, I appreciate that they actually go there, and they, I think they do it in a pretty, pretty harrowing way, is she considers killing herself. Mm. And I was not expecting Spencer to be, and I'm going to say this flat out, the best haunted house movie of the decade so far. Because that's what this feels like. She's trapped in a house haunted by tradition. Well, she's trapped by it.
Specifically by the first wife of King Henry VIII.
Yeah.
Who's name checked multiple times, and she feels like this specter of this woman is sort of hanging over her at all times. And she kind of, it's mostly her just sort of wandering around this big, kind of like haunted estate with ghouls lurking around every corner. And the ghouls just happen to be actual people who live there, including her husband.
Yeah. The royals, she can't trust the staff because the staff are part of this grand tradition. And the vast majority of them are at best gossiping about her and like don't have her best interests at heart.
At one point feels like she's kind of made a confidant in, I think he's the head butler. He's the character played by Timothy Spall.
Yeah.
And she at one point sort of confides in him. What are we even doing this for? And it's at that moment where he reveals that he's actually not on her side. And he actually does believe in these traditions. And he has a very inspiring speech that would be inspiring if she was inspired by it, but she's actually terrified
by it. If it actually catered to her principles, it's not. But it's not her principles. Mm. And it's nothing that she has any connection to or has any desire to defend.
Yeah, she
She has one actual servant who is on her side, played by Sally Hawkins. Mm. Sally Hawkins is amazing in this movie. She's amazing in everything.
This is a movie with Timothy Spall and Sally Hawkins, so you need to see it.
Just go see it. Those are two of the best actors working today. but Sally Hawkins is no sooner, she's like, oh, thank God, one person with whom I feel like I trust, someone who I feel like I can like be myself with. And then as soon as the royals find out that she has someone that she can trust to be herself with, she is whisked away in the middle of the night, so she won't be there anymore.
Yeah.
So Diana won't have anything like connecting her to reality. She will only be in this bizarre situation.
Yeah, it feels like she really is, like, through the looking glass. There are a few moments where she gets to be human. There's a wonderful scene where she just sort of has an evening of play with her kids.
Yeah, she has to do it in the middle of the night when no one's looking.
Yeah, yeah. And she kind of wakes them up and has sort of, like, playful word games with them in the middle of the night. And it's actually really very sweet.
Well, you get to see that she was actually, like, a mother and, like, actually got to have those connections with her children.
But then there's my favorite scene in the movie. It's clearly a fantasy sequence where she's sitting at a grand dinner. And she's sort of playing with her pearls nervously. And the pearls break and they sort of fall all over the table and nobody notices.
Uh-huh.
And they fall in her soup and she begins eating the pearls.
Yeah.
Like that.
Oh, and the pearls represent more than that, because it turns out that the pearl necklace she received from Charles for her wedding, he got the exact same gift for Camilla, his lover.
Yeah.
So it doesn't even mean anything. So she just starts eating them, and it's really, really horrifying. It feels like a scene right out of The Shining. Like, it really does. There's a sense of psychological despair.
It is this kind of horror movie moment.
It's psychological. And again, haunted house movies don't necessarily have to be literal. Rebecca is one of the great haunted house movies of all time. It's just haunted by a memory.
Hmm.
And that's what Diana's haunted by here. She's haunted by this, that's what a haunting is, isn't it? She's haunted by centuries of expectations and memories and the exploitation of women marrying into royal families. And it's driving her mad. And that's the thing. This movie plays pretty fast and loose with, like, sort of accuracy, because it's very...
It's a fictionalized version.
It's very fictionalized. It's very expressionistic. But I feel like it understands the psychological torment that she was going through. And I think that's what it wants us to understand.
Mm-hmm.
Is it may be difficult because of all of the opulence, because of all of the tabloid bullshit, to look at Diana as... I mean, not a person. We understand that she's a person. But to be able to understand what it was like to be her is really, really difficult. And I think that was the only thing on this movie's mind. And if everything else falls apart, as long as you understand just how desperate it felt. Yeah, okay, they're rich. Who gives a shit? It's misery. And I feel like that's the thing this movie captures really, really beautifully. And that's why I like this movie a lot, actually. At first, I couldn't quite figure out how to glom onto it, but once I realized this is a horror movie, this is a psychological thriller, that's when I started really connecting.
Like I said, it's very downbeat, it's very hazy, it's very scary. Mm-hmm. It's been criticized for that, not just because that's sort of some people don't necessarily want to dive into that mindset, but it's also been criticized by people who knew Diana, who actually wasn't miserable all the time.
I'm sure she wasn't in this movie, this weekend, you know?
There was actually a lot in her life where she was able to become a better, further-reaching humanitarian with sort of her power and her money.
100%.
She was in this position and didn't want to necessarily be remembered as this dour figure, but that is kind of where this movie is placing her. It's playing into yet another image of Di that it wasn't necessarily a full portrait of her. What I find really fascinating is Spencer is the latest in kind of a series of movies where we're going back and looking at the pilloried women of the tabloid era and giving them their humanity back. There was a film about Tanya Harding.
Yeah,
they gave
really
Tanya Harding her humanity back. Just this year, there was a film about Tammy Faye Baker trying to get her humanity back.
There have been documentaries about Britney Spears as well. You know?
The tabloids have ripped them apart for so long. We're finally picking the pieces back up.
Yeah,
Spencer feels like it is trying to be an incredibly sensitive and touching portrait of the pains that Diana went through, but it is also fictionalized, so we should perhaps take it with a little bit of a grain of salt.
And that's why I think playing it as such a genre film, I think, gives them a little bit of freedom to say, we're not giving you the complete picture.
Yeah.
We're talking about, again, this is during one moment of crisis. I mean, think about, I'm sure everyone at home, you know, you live long enough, you're going to encounter one moment of crisis. Does that does that moment, whether it lasted an hour, a weekend, a month, whatever, there's some really bad thing and everything just seemed like it was collapsing all around you and you had to make life-altering decisions under not great conditions. That's probably not representative of your whole life.
Yeah.
That was a weird time, and I feel like this is a portrait of that weird time, which is why, in many respects, I think this is actually a bad biopic. As a biopic, yeah. If you're looking for to be informed about Diana's life, you won't be. You'll hopefully be sympathetic to her plight.
This is one,
but
this
that's
is
not
a...
about. This isn't about illustrating or illuminating the facts or setting the story straight. This is not about that.
Well, this is some film that hopes you have you have feelings about Diana going in.
Yes,
that you know who she is and you know about her history.
Honestly, I can't imagine knowing nothing about her and going into this. It'd probably be really weird. We haven't really talked about Kristen Stewart. How do you feel she pulls this off?
Well, I mean, Kristen Stewart is one of the best actresses of her generation, quite frankly. I think she really kind of embodies the role in a way I really haven't seen Kristen Stewart do in the past. She's a very sensitive actress. She has a great deal of range, but she tends to be more comfortable creating characters out of whole cloth. Here she is saddled with that thing of creating an original character while also imitating the mannerisms of an existing human being. Mm-hmm. And I think she does it remarkably well.
Yeah.
While still bringing her performance to it. That's incredibly admirable.
Yeah, I agree. All right, what do you want to talk about next? Pick a film. Any film.
Let's see here. Let's talk about Finch.
Finch. Okay, another somewhat dour film.
Or as my wife put it, Bumpy's mom. Oh no, it's so sad.
So Finch is a new original sci-fi film on Apple Plus. Finch stars Tom Hanks as possibly the last man in the world. He is a robotics expert who is living in an old factory after a solar flare has burned off all of the ozone, and being outside in the sun for even a few seconds will burn your flesh. So most of humanity has died. Most of the food has been annihilated or obliterated, can't grow anymore. And right now, as far as Tom Hanks knows, it's just him and his dog, and that's it. And unfortunately, repeated exposure to UV radiation, even just going out trying to find dog food or anything that could suffice for it, has left him dying. He will die of radiation poisoning sooner than later. You know, he can't have a great diagnosis. He's not a doctor, but he knows he will die.
So, Tom Hanks, he is Finch. He has tasked himself with one final act on this world. The dog is everything. To quote Cormac McCarthy's The Road, each was the other's world entire. Oh, God.
Yeah, Finch promises it's going to be weeby, because the idea is he's going to build a robot.
He has to build a robot. And
that will take care of the dog.
Train it to love the dog before he dies.
So that the dog
That's
will
the
be taken care
of. That's the premise of the movie. And this is an Amblin film, so this is...
Yeah.
Like, this is not going to pull any of the sentimental punches you think it's going to. It's not directed by Spielberg, but it has Spielberg's note on it.
It's executive producer Robert Zemeckis, and I think it's got that quality. I am probably one of many people who grew up being exposed to, and I think that's the best word to use, the film Turner and Hooch. Turner and Hooch is a film, it's a funny movie, about Tom Hanks. He's a cop, and he has to team up with a funny dog that eats his car, and there's a scene where the dog's eating his car, and Tom Hanks is like, not the car! And it's one of the funniest scenes you've ever seen, and it's got one of the saddest endings of any movie.
Does the dog die?
Shut up.
Does the dog die?
Does he
have to kill the dog?
Have you never seen Turner and Hooch?
No, I don't see dog movies.
Okay, well, in any case, my point is this. there's certain family films that I'm not going to ruin the situations for you, but Bambi is one of them. Bad shit happens. Stuff that would traumatize a young person. So seeing another Tom Hanks movie with the dog and knowing the premise is Tom Hanks is dying and is trying to teach a robot to love a dog... I'm about to press play on this thing, and there's a part of me that's like, Tom Hanks is great. Visual effects technology has gone really, really far. This might very well be a very good movie, but am I really in the mood? And the answer was no. But I will tell you
this. sad. Not even depressing, just sad.
I don't gravitate towards sad stories. I don't object to them. Many of my favorite stories ever are sad stories. But I'm rarely in the mood. It's usually someone telling me you should see this. It's great. You should see it, and then I do, and I'm really, really glad I did. But if you like, if I'm just bored and just want to watch something, I'm not going to put in something sad. I'll probably put in something happy. That's just where I gravitate. So I was dreading this a little bit because I knew the premise, and I knew this is probably not going to end with surprise. Tom Hanks was misdiagnosed or something. Like we're probably not going there.
It's not really the end of the world.
Yeah, it turns out it was all a big surprise party, and boy was he surprised. No, it's going to go to some really, really heavy places, but I think it handles it beautifully. I think this is a really sweet film about someone who basically creates a son. The robot is eventually named Jeff, and he's played by Caleb Landry Jones. Very good actor.
Voiced by Caleb Landry Jones, and it's mostly puppeteering. In close-ups, it's an actual robot that is being puppeteered.
I actually wasn't aware of that. It looked good, though.
In long shots where you can see it like walking around, clearly that's CG.
In any case, I bought this robot hook, line, and sinker. I bought that, it was very childlike, but very eager and trying its best. And it gives this opportunity for Tom Hanks to have a son. Mm. And I'm mad because there's Tom Hanks in this movie has a beard. And in certain shots, he looks uncannily like my father towards the end of his life. So there are moments in this where he's being very honest and forthright about the end of his life and the regrets that he has and the things he wished he had done and how he may have sometimes been a good parent to Jeff and sometimes he may have been a bad parent to Jeff. And it reminded me very, very much of some of the last days with my father. And I will say this right now, as devastating as that was to relive, kudos to the film for taking this odd premise and actually evoking something that human.
Mm.
Tom Hanks is as good an actor as he's ever been, which is to say one of the best. He's really, really talented. The movie is small. It keeps threatening to become something a little bit more action-y, but it never quite does.
One of the premises of the film is that Finch, the Tom Hanks character, hates people. Yeah. He's kind of a misanthrope. He's perfectly happy to live with just a dog and never interact with other human beings. And now he's been forced into the position of having to teach something how to be a human. And he's trying to be kind of objective about it. And he realizes that in teaching this robot that he's actually teaching things to himself. And I like that aspect of it. And he also recognizes when he's teaching the robot bad things about his mistrust and his paranoia.
Yeah.
And this isn't about him growing up either. This is about just who he is. We know he's going
to
die.
Yeah, he doesn't have a lot of time left for character development right now. But he's able to acknowledge things about himself and achieve a certain amount of wisdom, I think, by the end. And I think that's really beautiful.
And meanwhile, there's still the fun Star Trek stuff where you get to think about the nature of a robot's consciousness.
Yeah.
And how you would teach a robot and what sort of things you would teach it. He's very careful right away to program in Asimov's Laws of Robotics.
Yep. That was cute. That was really... He adds one, which is the dog is everything.
Yeah. And rule number 4, protect the dog.
This is actually like, this is somewhat a weirdly non-cynical version of A Boy and His Dog, which is one of the great post-apocalyptic movies you've ever seen. It stars Don Johnson as like a teenager in the post-apocalypse who is just horny and lonely.
Looking to have sex with a woman.
Once before he dies. And he's got a dog with him, and the dog is, because of radiation, psychic.
And can communicate psychically with the dog. We get to hear the dog... voiceover.
It's incredibly bitter and cynical, and it's definitely not going to be for everyone's taste, but it's really interesting and really
going to be everyone's taste. That's one of the last lines of the movie.
Yeah, I apologize. it's very, very good, but this is sort of like the older, wiser, calmer version of that in a way. Just one person left with a dog, but it's sweet.
Yeah, it's impeccably made. It's a really slick-looking movie. Yeah. The robot is really great-looking.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if this ends up winning, like, Best Visual Effects, because, not that that's important, but, like, I feel like the Academy likes to reward films that use visual effects to tell a good story.
Tell an emotional story.
Regardless of whether or not they're oppressive, they care about this story. Like, the more likely a movie is to have been nominated for Best Picture, the more likely it is to win the Best Visual Effects Award.
Right.
And I think Finch might be good just because it's a great character.
Yeah. Something like Ex Machina wins Best Special Effects.
But it's just a wonderful character, Finch. Yeah. And I really do I really do love him very, very much.
The robot gets to name itself, and it chooses the name Jeff. And
after many tries, which I appreciate, it's a good conversation.
And you look in the credits and it's spelled with a J. If it had been spelled Jeff with G-E-O-F-F, I would kept on hoping it was spelled with a G because that would have been a reference to Craig Ferguson's talk show where he had a robot sidekick named Jeff.
Yes, he did.
I love Jeff. Jeff Peterson is the name of the robot skeleton. And I would like to think that the filmmakers were big fans of Craig Ferguson, but no, it is Jeff with a J.
No, anyway, very, very sweet movie. Do not miss it if you get the opportunity. It's very, very good. It's sad. But it's worth it. And it's coming from someone who doesn't necessarily love sad movies. But you know what I do love?
What do you love?
The Harder They Fall.
The Harder They Fall is awesome.
The Harder They Fall.
It's so freaking good.
I'm gonna use the word that the kids use. The Harder They Fall fucks. This movie is great. Holy shit, this film.
This is a Western film directed by The Bullets. AKA James Samuel. He is a songwriter, and this is a fictional film he's directing. It's semi-fictional in that the events of the film are all completely fabricated, but all the characters are real people.
Which is to say, they're basically doing like a Young Guns kind of vibe.
Yeah.
Emilio Estevez plays Billy the Kid in Young Guns. You know what never happened to Billy the Kid? 98% of the shit in that movie.
And this is sort of a vision of the Old West, where we don't get to spend any time with white people, and it's wonderful.
there's like two scenes with white people, and one of them, it's a joke.
They hold up a bank at one point, and all of the people in the bank are white people, and the interior of the bank is even white. It's painted white.
Well, they even say like we're going to like a town that's a white town. And then they go there, literally every building is white.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, all right, we're in this movie. This is the movie we're in.
Yeah.
We're playing a little fast and loose with history, but if it feels good and it's fun, we're going to do it.
When we go out into the real world, it's a completely African-American cast, and it's a lot more colorful. And this is sort of like... You look back at the Western genre, and it's old white, grizzled white men. And you look at
90% of it.
And you know, it was a racist time, but there were also out in the Old West. You know, before the states were sort of added to the United States, there was actually a lot more opportunity for black cowboys, and
there were a lot more people of color in the Old West than movies would suggest.
This is a movie that just sort of lets them have the space all to themselves, and I really appreciate that.
The cast is fucking phenomenal, just to give a quick...
Oh my god, yes.
Oh my god, so you got Jonathan Majors as Nat Love, an outlaw who makes his living stealing from other outlaws. Mm. You get his arch-nemesis Rufus Buck, played by Idris Elba, who Idris Elba kills Nat Love's father at the and mother at the beginning of the movie, and now
and carves a cross into his forehead with a straight razor.
You got Zazie Beetz as...
When we're introduced to the Idris Elba character, he's being transported like the Steve Buscemi character in Con Air or like Hannibal Lecter. He's in a safe.
Yeah.
And they open the safe and we don't see anything in it. It's just like this black space. Like you were talking about the negative zone.
Yeah.
It's like, and he emerges from the negative zone. It's like, oh shit, it's Idris Elba.
Yeah. You got Zazie Beetz as Stagecoach Mary, an outlaw who now like runs multiple businesses. Regina
and his Nat Love's ex-girlfriend.
Yep, you got Regina King as Treacherous Trudy. She's such a scene stealer. Holy shit, she's so good in this movie. Delroy Lindo as real-life lawman Bass Reeves, who, seriously, look up that guy. That guy is a legend in real life. Holy shit. You got Lakeith Stanfield as Cherokee Bill, another amazing fucking villain. You got RJ Seiler in here. You got Danielle Deadwyler, a character who is genderqueer. And that's really, really cool. There's a couple of bits where they don't feel like they handle that as well as they could have, but they still handle it better than most other movies are right now, so I'll give them some credit.
It's the Old West, and you can tell that they don't like have the language for genderqueer yet.
Agreed. I still think there's other ways the movie could have been even better about
her,
it, but still pretty
good. Her character is named Cuffy, played by a real person named Kathy Williams.
But modeled after a real person named Kathy Williams. Excuse me, yeah. You got Edie Cassidy in this. Damon Wayans Jr. is in this. The list goes on and on. All-star... incredible, and everyone's got a fun role. Everyone's got incredible scenes. I love the screenplay to this movie. The screenplay to this movie is, I would teach this in a class. The screenplay is so great because the story is actually very easy to follow. There's not a lot of gigantic twists and turns. It's clean. However,
it's essentially just about two rival gangs.
Yeah. However, almost every like scene begins in a way you're not expecting and concludes in a way you're not expecting. Mm-hmm. The whole bit where Regina King and Lakeith Stanfield rob a train, you think you know what they're doing. And then you realize, no, they're doing this. And then you realize they're doing this for this reason. And then you realize that after they've done this, they have to do this. Like, there's so many great reveals on top of reveals. The screenplay is... not being cute. Like, it's not trying to trick you. It's just revealing itself in a slightly unexpected way so that you are never for one second bored. You are always engaged with this thing. And on top of that, you've got absolutely phenomenal cinematography by Mihai Malamare Jr. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. Which... that person, who's also did the Paul Thomas Anderson's The Master... great looking movie. Did Jojo Rabbit, did The Hate U Give. They watched some Sam Raimi films, because this is not just gorgeously lit. It's a very nicely lit movie. The production design is fantastic. The costume design is impeccable. They do such great storytelling with camera work here. So much incredible just little bits in the middle of scenes where we're not just going to let it play out. We're going to make sure the camera is part of conveying this story. Through clever shots, bizarre zooms. It's really incredible.
This is what one of the things that makes this film stand out as much as it does. It uses... I've seen plenty of revisionist Westerns that very directly quote other films. And the filmmakers in many of these cases quote other films in the hopes that they can sort of like... piggyback on goodwill from other movies into the one they're making.
Yep. Oftentimes looking at spaghetti Western, sometimes more American classics like High Noon or whatever. Shane.
This is a film that is using a lot of the style from like some Sergio Leone or other old Westerns, but understands that these shots that it's selecting or these angles or, you know, putting the characters in the frame in such a way is actually in service of something, in service of communicating something about the character or something about the scene or the beats or the pacing of the thing.
You're not just using this shot to place yourself in context with other Westerns. You're using this shot because this is the shot that tells
the story. That tells this story best. And it looks like this other shot. And that's coincidence because this is actually just a good way to tell this kind of a story.
Yeah, I actually feel like if there's one Western it takes the most from, it's Sam Raimi's The Quick and the Dead, which is another story that tells itself through like camera language better than most others. But I've also noticed that it would name check things. Like, there's this great shot of Regina King at the beginning where she's motioning to all of her people to basically do whatever they planned. And it's a shot they lifted right from Malcolm X. It's the fingers. Just like they know exactly what they're quoting, and they know that the people in the audience who are in the know will recognize this, and it's in part of a legacy. But it is exactly what that moment needs. It's not just sitting there because it's a reference. And they're not even calling their shots. They're not even saying, oh, it's just kind of like blank. We're not doing that.
No, it takes the time. It is over. It's like about 2 hours and 15 minutes in length.
Doesn't feel it.
Well, it moves like a freight train, and that time gives all of these characters, and as a huge ensemble, to each emerge as a character. It's not just that they have one bit, or they all seem to have something to do, not in terms of plot, but in terms of relating to one another.
Yeah, they have emotional connections to each other, good guys and bad guys alike.
And did you notice the good guys and bad guys all wear black hats? That's kind of a cute little wink to the audience as well.
Everyone's having a good time.
But yeah, the story is, it's basically just two rival gangs. As you mentioned, the Idris Elba character killed Jonathan Majors father, family, and scarred him when he was a young boy, and now he's out for revenge, and he has to find where he is and kill him.
And Idris Elba is basically taking over this whole town.
Well, he's freed from jail, and he has to go back to the town he used to rule, and there's a really wonderful bit where he has to oust the guy who was running things while he was gone. And that character, like this Starscream-like character who is completely betrayed and, you know, is kind of like sucking up to him now, but you know, secretly wants to betray him at all times. That character is really wonderful. And he has his posse who's protecting him, and that's Regina King and Lakeith Stanfield and others as well. Meanwhile, Jonathan Majors, Zazie Beetz, Delroy Lindo, and a few others have all banded together in order to sort of track this guy down and take him down.
And these are larger than life, pulpy heroes, but every single time the story slows down even a little bit, we're learning more about their characters. Regina King is this incredible sequence where she's just basically talking about that time that she killed someone because they hurt her sister. And it's this really long monologue. And the movie knows that Regina King is so fucking talented, we can stop this movie. There's no plot going on right now. We can stop this movie, and she will make that magnetic for 5 fucking minutes before we go into anything plot-related again.
There are multiple references from multiple characters about surviving domestic abuse.
Yeah.
And it does sort of tie in abuse and the sort of unhealthy environment in which you experienced your upbringing leads to the sort of violence that they're now living.
Yeah.
It's not just sort of a natural expected part of the Old West, as learned from movies.
People like grow up in violence and they come to expect it.
So there's this theme of perpetuating violence as part of the cycle, which goes right into a genre study of what the Western is. But at the same time, even though it has these sort of echoes back into domestic abuse, it doesn't fall into that Unforgiven trap of self-pity.
No.
Where the heroes are all kind of feeling sorry for...
They're young still, you know?
Some of them are young, some of them are older.
But like Delroy Lindo is the only one who's like an old man at this point. And even he's not falling into that trap. It's not about like, oh, I was violent once and I regret my ways. It's like, they're living in a violent world. They're thriving in a violent world. They're enjoying a violent world.
But they're not psychopaths who enjoy the violence.
Like one or two of them are, but they're the bad guys, so that's fine. Yeah. But like the majority of the characters here are doing what they did. Like Lakeith Stanfield is a monster in this movie. Oh, you can also tell he would rather not be. Like, I don't want to have to do any of this shit, but I will kill anyone in the most underhanded, sadistic, horrible way possible if it means that I don't get hurt.
There's a wonderful conceit of his character. It's like, you're the fastest draw in the West. You killed everybody by shooting them in the back. Like, so he's...
They keep building up to this.
He's like a badass, but he's also a coward.
They keep building up to this, like, the idea is that one of Nat Love's men fancies himself a quick draw artist, and he's been wanting to... have a duel with Lakeith Stanfield, and they keep building to it, and I'm not going to tell you what happens. What I will say is this: wasn't expecting it to go down that way, and it's very good. Like they handle it really, really great. It's very satisfying in a dramatic way. This is one of the best movies of the year.
I agree.
It's November. I feel comfortable. I don't like throwing that around until it's nearly the end of the year. But we're almost halfway through November. Okay? I feel comfortable saying that this is one of the best movies of the year. If it doesn't end up in my top 10, it means that at least 7 amazing movies came out this year. Because right now there's only like 3 or 4 movies that I would say are a safe bet that I've seen that are going to have in my top 10 of the year.
Golly, I have at least a dozen.
There's a lot of movies I really, really liked, and I'd be very happy to put them on there, but there's only like 3 or 4 that I feel like are 100%, no matter what else comes out at the end of the year, 100% guaranteed to be on my top 10 at the end of the year because they meant so much to me. I keep thinking about them. I haven't lost them at all. This is one of those. This movie is alive. This movie is vibrant. This movie is exciting. This movie is funny. This movie is sexy. This movie is everything. Do not miss this movie. It's really fucking good. And it's very entertaining. Like, I want more movies done with this energy. They don't have to be on this exact same way, but I want this, like... I may never make another movie again. I'm putting every fucking thing I can think of, every fucking bit of passion, every bit of exuberance. This movie is just desperate to make the most of its existence, and not a frame feels wasted. There's a couple of bits I feel with the genderqueer character, which a couple of line changes, bits of dialogue could have handled that a little bit more smoothly. But even then, still nicely done.
Yeah.
But overall, it just, you know, like you change like four lines of dialogue, it ends up being like really transcendent. That's the most I can complain about this movie. And it's not nothing, but it is not enough to hurt it in this movie is
it's
bad kind of way.
It's the excitement of a filmmaker who is excited to make a movie and actually has something to say,
yeah,
and has a way they want to say it. Mm-hmm. I was reminded of in a weird way, Sorry to Bother You, another like Keith Stanfield.
Oh, yeah. That's another one.
Also,
that has
also
yeah.
about another musician directing a film. Where they just sort of had the excitement of being behind a camera and a lot of ideas of how to tell a story using cinema language, and mm-hmm. was just sort of falling over themselves to tell as exciting and visually compelling a story as possible while still displaying a talent and a skill to wrangle it all in. There's mm-hmm. a way to display a lot of enthusiasm and just fall all over yourself and make a mess. Neither Sorry to Bother You nor The Harder They Fall has that quality. It is actually incredibly disciplined for how excitingly enthusiastic it is.
Yeah. And I actually want to apologize in case I made an assumption here. At no point in the movie, I think partly because the language wasn't there yet at the time, does the character of Cuffy specify that they are trans or genderqueer. But what they are certainly is masculine presenting. And so there's definitely, it's in that... It's in that Venn diagram.
Yeah, I don't know if there's any stigma attached to the word tomboy anymore. I don't hear it used a lot anymore.
That's not
but
this. They want to be treated as male. That's not the same thing. It's in any case, mostly beautifully handled. One or two scenes where it's not, but it's still really good. Okay, well, let's move on. We only have one left.
I didn't see this, so tell me about this last film.
The last film is a biopic called The Electrical Life of Louis Wain. And I want to make sure I get the filmmaker's name right, because I forgot. Will Sharp. Will Sharp directed this movie. It stars Benedict Cumberbatch as a real-life turn-of-the-century artist whose big claim to fame was cats. He drew cats. He drew many cats. He drew anthropomorphized cats. He drew cute cats. He drew psychedelic cats.
Did he draw angelical cats?
He probably had some influence on that as well. Louis Wain helped change the way people see cats in the modern world. Cats were not seen.
Okay.
Cats were not typically pets.
Mm-hmm.
They were kept around to hunt mice, but they weren't considered like, oh, they're so cute, let's let them sleep on the bed and give them funny voices. Like, this sort of fancifulness that we now accept with cats constantly on mm-hmm. this podcast is... in a not insignificant way, influenced by the work of Louis Wain, whose paintings of cats, which he drew while his wife was dying of cancer, because they had a cat together and everyone thought they were weird for doing it, and it made his wife happy, and it made him feel good. And then he started selling these pictures of cats, and they started selling like hotcakes, and they helped popularize cats. And then his wife died, and he had nothing else to do, so he kept making cats. And that's what he would do. And then Louis Wain had some form of undiagnosed or improperly diagnosed mental illness probably over the course of his life. Mm-hmm. And he started to believe weird things about how cats are going to learn how to talk. And eventually, once they absorb enough electricity in the air, they're going to turn blue. And it's going to be really cool. And it starts getting a little troubling. And you start really worrying about him.
Mm-hmm.
Benedict Cumberbatch is such a sort of a typically towering presence in a movie. He's very tall. He's got that really deep voice. He seems to he exudes a lot of authority.
He's got a lot of range, though. He can play sort of timid and quiet as well.
I believe so as well. But I think what he's doing here is, I think he's doing something really, really strong here, which is he's got that sort of confidence, but it feels completely misplaced. And he keeps talking about all these things he's going to invent and they'll never happen, and all these bizarre ideas he has about how electricity is connecting us all, almost like a rudimentary string theory. And it really highlights his fragility, his emotional fragility as a person, and how he's never felt comfortable. He's the only male in his family. He has a bunch of sisters. And so because of the norms of the time, he is put in charge of taking care of the household. He is completely ill-prepared for that, has no interest in it, has no head for money whatsoever, ends up screwing himself out of almost all of the money he could have made off of the cat drawings, because he never actually copyrighted all of them. So people are just copying them everywhere, and he's not seeing, he's only seeing it's a penny off the original sale. And it's basically just he struggled, couldn't find his place. He was briefly happy with the woman he loved, played by Claire Foy. And then she died way too early in their lives. And then he found a niche. People liked it when he was doing this thing, but that was it. That's all he had to connect to. He didn't connect to anyone else in his life in a meaningful way. And he just floundered for decades. People appreciating his work, but not knowing what to do with him.
Yeah.
And that sense of loneliness, that sense of being a bit ahead of his time. There's this bit, it reminded me of that scene at Eternity's Gate where Mads Mikkelsen goes up to Vincent van Gogh and says, "Why do you think you're an artist? Your work is disturbing and inaccurate and bad." And Vincent van Gogh is just like, "Well, maybe someday people will think it's good." And there's a bit where he's institutionalized. And he's doing these really incredible, beautifully detailed, psychedelic images of cats. And they're just like, it's so sad to see their talent wasted and just gone away. And I'm like, oh my God, he's ahead of his time. This is incredible. Well,
I'm looking up, I'm looking at some Louis Wayne paintings right now.
Louis,
and,
by the way.
Louis Wayne paintings right now. And there is one I'm familiar, very familiar with, because you see it on like pillows at Walmart and stuff. Yeah. But it's called a Kaleidoscope Cats 3.
Yeah.
And it's a white cat with sort of like electric lines coming off of it.
Yeah.
This is like, I think, a Margaret Keane situation where it took on like sort of this commercial dimension. A lot of people like wanted to hang this in their art, in their living rooms.
Well, they were collecting in like postcards and shit. Yeah, it was very common.
But it has sort of a kitsch quality, and whether or not it's good or bad is a matter of debate.
Well, what the movie argues, and I think reasonably successfully, is even if other people are appreciating this ironically or whimsically or superficially, it meant a lot to him. And I think the movie conveys that quite nicely. Okay. And I think the Will Sharpe has an interesting sort of hallucinogenic quality to the storyline that... It doesn't, it's not like Spencer, where I feel like we're really just welcomed into Louis Wayne's world. I think Will Sharpe just believes that the turn of the century was a really weird time. And things were dramatically changing, and people were eager to believe things that made no sense, but they were desperate to be modern. And there was this general sense of people just searching for identity, searching for the future, searching for change. And here's someone who found themselves quite accidentally at the center of that. It's not amazing. I'm not like deeply in love with this movie. It's certainly not one of the best movies of the year, but it's a sweet movie. And I think it's a very sympathetic movie. And I think Benedict Cumberbatch is very good in it. I really like Claire Foy here. Her role is short because, you know, she passes away shortly at the beginning of the movie. But I think she really controls the screen whenever she's on it. Andrea Riseborough plays his oldest sister.
Oh, I love Andrea Riseborough.
And you keep thinking she's going to be a bigger part in the movie, but she ends up just being this sort of interesting... She seems just at first like disapproving, almost like Adam Sandler's sisters in Punch Drunk Love. But by the end of the film, you realize that she had her own story going on, and it's very sweet. So yeah, I like this movie. I think it's eccentric and distinct and sweet. It might be biting off more of its chew. It might be trying to make too big a thing out of the cat stuff. But kudos to them for basically plucking an interesting artist out of history and trying to give them their story and trying to show them in as positive a light as they can, and raising awareness of a person who, honestly, I was... at best, vaguely familiar with. I'd seen some of the drawings before, but I really didn't know anything about them. And I'm sure the movie takes a lot of liberties, but, you know, I think that's something that a biopic should do if they're trying to be a complete biopic, an educational biopic, is to give you some sense of them so that you'd want to do more actual research. Mm. And they did that. So kudos for that. All right, that is it for Critically Acclaimed. It is time to review some movies on the Critically Acclaimed scale. Once again, our Critically Acclaimed scale ranges from C- to C+. The lowest you can get is a C-. That's below average. Everything from, we just don't recommend it, to it's really terrible. C is average. Some good, some bad. Well, maybe better for some audiences than others. And C+ is, we genuinely recommend this movie. You should check this movie out. It's excellent, highly entertaining, maybe even brilliant. And on that note, The Electrical Life of Louis Wayne is a very high C. It's told with some panache. I think the acting is very, very good in it. It's not like a you must see this before the end of the year kind of thing. But it's on Amazon Prime, and it's sweet, and I did mostly like it.
Okay.
What do we have? The Harder They Fall.
This is C+ all the way. I encourage everyone to see this. This is one that needs to be talked about. This is one where, in a just world, posters of this thing would be up in college dorms. It's one of these things that really can dominate the popular consciousness in a big, big way and move cinema forward in this type of like action cinema forward in an important way. And I really hope people discover it.
I'm with you. This is a C+, underlined in italics and in boldface. This is excellent filmmaking, top to bottom, highly entertaining and very rich. I don't know what's going to happen with this. I agree. This is something that should be seen as cool. And whether it gets like awards talk at the end of the year, which I think it should, or whether it's not, I think it's something that with time is only going to get bigger and bigger and bigger.
Yeah.
Because this is fucking awesome is what it is. What about Finch?
Finch is, it's a C. It's really quite good. Okay. It's a very high C or maybe a very low C+.
You gotta pick one.
Oh God, must I?
Wait, is it that hard? Really? Pick a thing.
I'll give it a low C+. Then. Okay. Just to give it its due. I think it is a really good character piece. I think it is, of course, an incredibly manipulative, sentimental drama about Tom Hanks, teaching a robot to love a dog. It's trying to make you cry. It is a hanky film, but it does it, and it does it well. Yeah. So go Finch.
I think it's a little unfair. I think it's all movies are trying to manipulate you on some level. What I'm offended by is when I can see them doing it.
You understand when I say manipulative.
I know, right? But I'm going to clarify that the only time that offends me is when I can see them doing it, and I can see them trying to make it work in spite of itself. Not because the material actually earns it, but because they just want us to do it. And here I think it's actually pretty genuine, and I actually appreciate that this much, this much sci-fi storytelling and this much technical wizardry can be used to tell a simple story like this, an intimate story like this, and that it can be very affecting. So I'm giving it a solid C+. I think it's really good. Tom Hanks is really good in it. Caleb Landry Jones is good in it. I was convinced by the visual effects the whole time. And it was very, very sweet. Let's see here. Spencer.
Spencer is also a C+. Just a lot of good ones this week.
Really good week. Really good week.
Kind of strange, hazy, gallows, haunted house picture version of the life of Diana Spencer is fascinating, and Kristen Stewart is wonderful in this movie. And the way it sort of plays with the emotional life of somebody who, to the outside world, seems like a glittering celebrity, but who is in fact trapped in this old system that doesn't function for anyone. It's a really compelling drama.
I think the strongest critique you can have against Spencer is, as we said, it's not actually doing all of its job as a biopic. However, once you accept that it's not trying to, I think you've got something that's incredibly evocative, incredibly riveting, and frankly, scary, like emotionally scary, what's going on here. And on that note, I think it's very, very, very strong. I'm going to give it a C+ as well. And then lastly, I'm curious where you're going to land on this. Eternals.
Eternals is... It's a bit of a mess because it's two things that don't fit well together. Mm-hmm. But I really liked one of those things a lot. And that's sort of the pervading idea and the overall emotional thrust I got from the film mm-hmm. left me thinking very fondly of it. So I'm going to give it a C+.
Okay.
But it is a qualified C+ in that there's a lot in this movie that doesn't function well at all.
Yeah. I'm going to give it a very high C for that reason. Okay. Ultimately, I really appreciate the ambition, and I think that there's a lot in this movie that really does work and is trying to touch at something profound. But I think it's undermined by its...
Genre trappings. Yeah.
Not the genre trappings so much as its awkward attempts to connect to something that has nothing to do with it, except in a superficial way.
Yeah.
And that's the part that kind of, if it had been allowed to be more separate, I mean, you could still have it be part of the MCU without talking about Captain America and shit. Mm. Every single time they do something like that, or when someone says, well, actually, I have a secret backstory, I don't care. Yeah. All of that stuff is the least interesting thing about it. The post-credits teases, least interesting thing about it. Mm. The story itself is the most interesting thing. And there's just a few things holding that back from being truly great. But a big swing, a good swing. I mostly enjoyed it. Mm. It's a high C.
The most awkward moment for me was, you know, we're in Chloe Zhao's, you know, beautiful cinematography. Mm-hmm. We're seeing actual landscapes. It's not a CG. And we get to see Selma Hayek. She's essentially dressed as, like, in Old West garb. She's got, like, a cowboy hat on. She's sitting on the porch of this little tiny shack in the middle of South Dakota. And Icarus walks up to her. She's sort of, like, leaning back. It's like, we're sort of in this contemplative space where these ancient beings
are. It looks like it's right out of an assassination of Jesse James by the coward Robert Ford. It looks like it's right out of that.
And she says, hey... Remember when Thanos did that thing? I was like there's a record scratch, car crash noise in my head. It's like, wait a minute, why did you just say the word Thanos? Oh my God, it's like the strangest, most awkward thing.
Yeah, it doesn't seem to fit at all. It's super weird.
But, those moments kind of like drag it down a little bit.
But you know what I will say is that there's a lot of filmmakers out there who will make something for a franchise, and there's nothing wrong with that. It can be fun, they can enjoy it can open up a lot of doors for them, show that they can be trusted with bigger budgets. A lot of filmmakers have made good use out of that.
And these movies tend to be incredibly financially successful, regardless. So,
but few filmmakers, I think, have kept their own sense of style, panache, intact the way that Chloe Zhao has. There's a few, but I think Chloe Zhao has... This doesn't feel like I just made... a Marvel movie. Like, no, they tried to do it their own way. Yeah, it's a little clunky in places, but probably how could it not be? Mm-hmm. So honestly, like, I think they mostly kept this feeling very different and distinct.
And I hope the studio lets artists do their thing more moving forward. I know
they can afford to.
Yeah.
The movie did fine. Especially considering it's COVID still, you know?
The films where, you can sort of feel the artist's stamp, we're dealing with the kinds of filmmakers who can work in sort of a big commercial space.
Yeah.
So someone like Shane Black. Iron Man 3 feels like a Shane Black movie.
Oh, because Shane Black
makes big action spectaculars.
He did Lethal Weapon and Long Kiss Goodnight. Yeah, so it's not that far outside of his range.
Yeah, he's used to working in that mold anyway, so of course it feels like a Shane Black movie. Ryan Coogler was able to sort of walk the line a little bit.
Yeah, Ryan Coogler's another good example of it.
I don't have a lot of faith in what Sam Raimi is going to do with a new Doctor Strange, because I've seen him do both, where he's able to keep his voice through a big blockbuster and then not keep his voice through a big blockbuster.
Yeah, I think he kept it mostly in the Spider-Man movies. And a movie I like, but it's not a great Sam Raimi film, is Oz the Great and Powerful.
You like Oz the Great and Powerful?
I think it's got some fun ideas. I think it mostly works well as a film, but it just doesn't have that Sam Raimi panache, does it?
Yeah. I feel like Spider-Man 2, that's a big blockbuster, but it still feels like a Sam Raimi film.
Oh, yeah.
His other Spider-Man films, less so, I feel.
I still feel more so than most, but anyway. That's it.
But yeah, I hope that they continue to hire interesting filmmakers. And let them do what they want with these thousands of characters.
Yeah. I get that there's got to be some limitations because we're all working together this. But this one could have been even more off in its own corner than it was.
The appeal of this series is that they all interconnect, that it is a TV series. I understand that. I also don't find that terribly interesting. That's one of the least interesting aspects.
Now it's the norm, isn't it? At first it was interesting just because they were doing it and they never done it before. And now it's the norm. And now we appreciate that. Okay, that's fine. But sometimes it can hold us back instead of actually freeing us for bigger things.
Well, and now they're teasing characters that definitely don't have any mass pulp or mass appeal to a broad audience.
There's teasing
the character of Quicksilver, for instance.
Yeah,
some people might know who Quicksilver is.
Yeah, he read X-Men comics. Mm. He was in there. Like you could when they did that there's at the end of whatever movie that was. It's like, oh, Quicksilver and Scarlet Witch are coming.
There's,
I know them
because this is a Marvel film, and I'm not going to say who it is. But there's a tease of other characters, and I can guarantee you don't know who those people are.
Yeah.
And you don't know their significance in the Marvel universe. Nobody does. They're really, really obscure.
I know.
Of course you know.
I'm just saying, some people do. But the mainstream, it's basically just like, oh, so there's just going to be a new character now.
Yeah.
That's kind of all we're getting out of it. And that feels like it's kind of lazy. It doesn't feel like a tease anymore at that point. It just feels like we're trying
to... This is just part of the formula now.
Well, it's not exciting, the tease. It's not just like, ooh. Like, at the end of Iron Man, and I know that initially they didn't know what their plan was. They just thought they'd try it.
Mm.
At the end of Iron Man, A, we meet Nick Fury, and he's played by Samuel L. Jackson. Fundamentally cool.
Mm.
But B, he says, hey, I'm starting up the Avengers. That's a promise. That's something that's like, ooh, that's a big deal. That's something that no one's ever done before.
But it wasn't supposed to be a series. That was Jon Favreau said in interviews, that was just a gag for fans.
We just thought that'd be neat.
We weren't going to make Avengers. This was going to be the end of the whole thing. We're going to make one Iron Man film. Yeah.
If it makes money, maybe we'll get to do more. But if it doesn't, we had the fun tease.
Mm-hmm.
But the point is that that's tantalizing. That's like, ooh, how interesting. The post-credit scenes in Eternals, without describing anything about them, none of that.
Mm-hmm.
At best, you might be interested in, like, the actor. Maybe you know the character they're playing from the comics. But it doesn't open up the world.
No.
It doesn't suggest something exciting and new. It's basically like, oh, maybe that character will get their own movie.
And that character
I guess.
Do a thing or something.
Yeah, neat, I guess. I don't know. Worse things have happened.
But this widget ties into this other widget. And there's
going to
be a bigger story about
magic
widgets.
Anyway, that one and Venom, Let There Be Carnage, all a lot of people wanted to talk about was a post-credit sequence, and they were the least interesting things about both movies. The least interesting thing about both movies to me.
In terms of Venom, it kind of wrecked what I liked about those Venom movies.
Yeah, I agree. I know,
we'll talk about
that. We got to keep going. Anyway, thank you so much for listening to Critically Acclaimed this week. We hope you're having a good week, month, life. Please keep doing that. If you want to join the conversation, there's several ways to do that. You can certainly send us an email. Our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. We might read your email on an upcoming episode of our podcast, We've Got Mail, also here on this channel. Whitney, what is our P.O. box? People who like snail mail?
Send us in an actual physical letter. Write it to the Critically Acclaimed Network, P.O. Box 641565, Los Angeles, California, 90064.
Yeah. And, of course, we are on Twitter at Critic Acclaim, not Critically Acclaimed, Critic Acclaim. I am at William Bibbiani.
I'm at Whitney Seibold.
And of course, we want to give a very special shout out to all of our patrons, without whom this show, all of our shows, none of our shows would exist without our patrons over at patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork. If you join up, you can vote for future episodes of some of our shows. You get bonus podcasts about Batman, every single episode of Star Trek, every single film ever nominated for Best Picture, commentary tracks. We do monthly hangouts. It's a lot.
Hmm.
And that's coming up. Every single week, sometimes every single day, over at the Critically Acclaimed Network Patreon. So thank you to all of our patrons, without whom we would not be here. I'm just incredibly grateful. We just released a whole bunch of new soap on the Salt Cat Soap Store over on Etsy. You can follow us on Instagram and Twitter and Facebook at Salt Cat Soap. We have some cool gift sets available for the holidays. We've got ornament soap. We've got soap that smells like gingerbread lattes. We got a lot of fun seasonal items that just debuted over there. And thank you everybody who's already purchased from the store. We appreciate it. And the reviews have been really kind. And just very, very glad for that. So I think that's everything.
That's everything for now.
Cool. All right, we're out of here. Never forget, everyone's a critic.
I wanna go to the midnight show. what?